Gee, are these alcoholics? How many Hawthorne? I'm an alcoholic. And these alcoholics exaggerate. I don't have 32 years of sobriety. I have to wait until September the 22nd before I have 32 years of sobriety. So today I have 11,613 days, a day at a time. There's an emergency call here for Linda Dip in the hall phone. Is she here? Linda. Linda Dip. You know, we got 22 new friends with us tonight. How about that? Let's give them a hand. Real good. You know, it's not how long you drank or what you drank. It's this year. I bet. It is nice. You know, knowing I'm an alcoholic is very nice, you know. I know that, too. I didn't know that. I really didn't have too much trouble with my drinking until I was about 15 years old. I'm still a little passing out, you know what I mean? I was an orphan, and my mother died. I don't remember my father. My mother died when I was 4 years old. And I was raised by gangsters and Christians. That's a nice combination. I learned something from both of them, not much. First time I got married, I was 17 years old. And I'll tell you, typical, it was on October the 29th, 1929. If you're old enough, you remember what day it was. That's when the stock market went to hell. And so did she. And I had to borrow $2 from her to get married. She had a job. All the times I've been married frequently. Every wife I have a job. You know? They like to eat, you know what I mean, and have nice things. That wasn't my bag. I wasn't too responsible. I knew when I was 21 years old that I was going to get a large sum of money. And so I couldn't wait, you know. I couldn't wait till I was 21. And so I had a grandfather who had sort of a drinking problem. I had him go down and lie to the judge for me. You know, I gave him $50 for it. He was very generous. And I got the money, and so then I got a divorce. And I paid $50 for the divorce. That was generous of me. And I gave her $10 for her trouble. And I kept about $7,500 for myself. In those days, you know, it was quite a bit of money. I entered into politics, and that's a good profession. And I became a chief investigator for prosecuting attorney. And I used it for everything but what you're supposed to use it for. And one day the judge called me in, a guy named Judge Wolf, and he looked like Abraham Lincoln, and he was just as honest. And he told me some of the things I was doing, and I denied him, actually. He says, I want you to turn in the badge. I sent you to the penitentiary. So I turned in the badge. Right? Stupid. You know. And this is the way my life run pretty much on self-will. I didn't realize it. I was doing the best I knew how. I thought this is the way to live. I always had a drink. I always drank. At 15, the reason I said, that's when I started the morning drink. And I never did drink to get drunk. I drank to feel good. When I felt good, I wanted to feel gooder. I don't know about you, but that's the way I felt. And, you know, you cross that line, you know what I mean, and what happened. Incidentally, after this divorce, I opened up a nightclub. And I was carrying, you know, all these good friends around with me. And I was my best customer, you know. I hired all the beautiful waitresses, you know, and I called it the Gypsy Tavern. I had a very imaginative, and I'd run them around like gypsies too, believe me. They'd run faster than me. And one day, you know, and I took his partner in, and very, you know, the guy was a businessman, and he was supposed to know what he was doing. And one day the sheriff came in and closed me up, you know. I was signing checks, and he was supposed to sign them too, but he wasn't, you know. And he was living in pretty good style. And so, I don't know, I sort of used to get angry occasionally. And I went over to his home, and naturally I went in, and his wife let me in, and I went up to his bedroom, and I pulled out this gun. When this judge took away this badge, he didn't take away the gun. And I took this gun and I put it to this man's head, and I was about ready to pull the trigger. And this woman saved my life. She says, "You know what's going to happen to you if you pull that trigger?" I didn't give a damn what happened to him, but you know that restored his sanity. So I broke his arm and I left. You know what I mean? I learned all those things when I was young. And, after this little thing, and one day I'm a big shot, and the next day I'm a nothing, and I mean, it's kind of hard to take. I had a Ford Roadster, you know, like a convertible with a rumble seat and real good shape, and I loved it. And they come and took that away from me. You know? And actually, I didn't have too much going. And the same people who I kind of shunned when I was in the box, I have to be honest about it. I used to occasionally go down and see them. I finally tried to stay out of the way, but they found me, and they took me back in and started talking to me and asked me, you know, they didn't want me to suffer. They knew I was out in the cold. But, you know, I don't know if you were like me, but that guilt and that remorse was so deep, you know. And I didn't know how to apologize. So the best thing, I joined the Navy. Let's press good, right? Get the hell out of there. I heard some good things about the Navy. And so I had a congressman and a United States senator sign for me. And they were glad to get rid of me. They thought I might blackmail them, and which I wasn't capable of doing. I was too stupid. And when I went in the service I started drinking and got around the people who drank. That's the only people I ever associated with, people who drank. And so here I am getting in a little bit of trouble, not much, and they're restricting me when I'm out at sea. There's no problem. Since I hit the shore, away you go again. You know? And that's about the way it went. I went around the world, and this is running through, you know, minor little things, and people died around me, and I'm drinking the same thing they are down in Java and places like this, and I don't know, they picked up a fever, but whether it was the booze I was drinking or something, anyway, I didn't get it, and they all died, and geez, this was bad, this was sad, and anyway, I was a booze head, any way you look at it. When I went ashore, I drank, I had fun, and who the hell cares? This is what I thought life was really about. Again, when I was aboard ship, I'd done what I was supposed to do. And if I didn't, it would throw me out. But, you know, I mean, you've heard about this. You worked like the dickens to keep up the good face, you know what I mean? And then in case you do get in trouble, you know, you got a pretty good record. Now, I didn't think about these things through my inventory. And looking back, this type of a person I was, I could come up with all this stuff. In June of 1937, I stood before the captain of the ship subject to a general court-martial, hitting an officer, which is not supposed to do, cussing out an admiral, you know, and that's cardinal sin in the Navy, living in. And all these women, these officers' wives, telling them what they were. And some of them were and some of them weren't. But there wasn't none of my business. And they sort of frowned on those things. And I had a big mouth, and I couldn't keep it shut. It gave me a lot of trouble. And so anyway, man, I don't know about you, but when I was in trouble, I could be humble. So I found out they had a chaplain aboard ship, and I saw him out naturally. And I told him a lot of lies, and he believed me, poor me, I mean, and he was going to help me. And when a day came, and before the captain, and we went up there, and my engineering officer talked well about me. There was a doctor who I had called a harsh doctor not long before that, and that's kind of bad. And anyway, that man said something again that saved my life. He said that I was a type of a person. When I drank, it affected me like ether. And after so many drinks, I really wasn't responsible for my actions. Does that ring a bell? Yeah. And true, there's actually, and the captain bought it, and he told me if I didn't get in trouble on the next 90 days aboard that ship, that he would take it out of my record. But see, he didn't restrict me. And again, I knew when I drank, I could never guarantee my behavior. And I found that also in the 80s. And so I started acting like I was nuts. Recovered. But, and I went in the hospitals and they x-rayed my head, didn't find anything there, that's for sure. And the rest of my body was in pretty good shape. Some parts weren't, but you know what I mean. That happens if you drink a lot. So anyway, they sent me over and they did the best they could. And as soon as I could, I'd be out and I'm, you know, running around and drinking. And the doctors come around and I told them that they made me nervous. I used every excuse. But I didn't want to leave the Philippine Islands. This is where it happened to be at the time. And anyway, one day they called me in and gave me a piece of paper and sent me back to the States. And I wouldn't come back to the States. I didn't have much choice. And when I hit Mare Island, it was the same thing. They let me have liberty, and I come back drunk, overlaid, and hid out for about 3 days. They finally found me. Gave me all the tests. Again, they couldn't find too much wrong with me physically, so they took out my tonsils. They didn't need to be taken out. I don't know. But they had to find something. And anyway, they called me in to the board one day, and the psychiatrist talked to me, and I gave him a long answer, I guess. He would call me a wise ass, which I didn't think I was. All he said is, I was out playing golf. I learned how to play golf in the Navy. It was amazing. And he said, when you're out on that field, are you afraid? And I said, what's there to be afraid of? And that's when he came out with his $60,000. You know, and I didn't realize what he was talking about. And the next day, believe it or not, they separated me from the United States Navy with an honorable discharge, and which I deserved. You know, I was hard working. And I went back to St. Louis, my hometown. I got back in politics, and I found a girl had a job, so I got married. Now I'm going to Washington, D.C., elected to congressman, you know. We had a victory celebration. The only thing is, I shouldn't have been there. And I don't remember being there. And the next day, the congressman stuck his head in the door and he says, how you feel, Ed? And I says, terrible. He said, come on, I'll take you out and get a couple of hookers. You know, he's talking about the shot glass. And so after I got a couple of drinks from there, he says, you know what you did last night? I says, I don't want to know what I did. He says, Forget it. He says, I thought Joe was a friend of yours. I says, Joe is one of the best friends I have. Joe happened to be the prosecuting friend. He says, well, if he's such a friend of yours, why did you break his glasses? I threw him out of a 10-story window. He says, how do you treat your enemies, Joe? I really didn't have too much answers. And needless to say, I didn't go to Washington, D.C. And, you know, the World War II broke out about that time, and they got me a job, and I had a good job. And I held on to it. I was afraid. I didn't want to lose faith. I didn't want that pride, that damn pride. I hated the job. And they couldn't fire me, and I stuck. I could have quit any time, but I stayed with it, and I hated it. And when the war broke out, the company shut down. So I came out to California. I found a job out here, and I brought a wife and a dog with me. God bless the dog. And the dog saved my life many times. And we hit San Francisco and got a hotel that took dogs and did me and wife. I never will forget it. I says, you know, honey, I think I'll take the dog for a walk. You know? And when I said very honestly and sincerely, when I'm out, I think I'll have a couple of beers. Now, I hadn't had a drink in 10 days. It took me 10 days to drive all that distance when the band was gone. And so about 3 days later, I came back. And I had the dog, but I didn't have any money and don't know where I was. And I guess the dog led me back to the hotel, really. I'll be honest with you, I really didn't know. What transcribed in the 3 days, I'll never know. It's complete blackout. And it's never been revealed again, and maybe I'm glad. So anyway, right then, you know, that old panic button is there. And so I sold the car, brand new car, for $200. First guy offered to me a shirt, boom. And then I had too many hills in Frisco, so I went to Los Angeles, gave those people a break. You know? And this girl, a very nice person, still is. And she went to work for Lockheed and was doing a good job, and I stayed until all the money was gone, and then that old guilt started setting in again. And so I figured, well, I better do something. And Half drunk, I went out to Lockheed and they hired me. They were hiring senile dogs at the time, and never getting paid. And then I was doing a good job for a while, and so I started getting drunk on the job, and that's a no-no. The supervisor was getting drunk, and he would get drunk like when I. And I went in there one day, and I don't want to forget it. I went in, and I couldn't even hit the deck with my hat, to be honest. And they let me in. And I saw the supervisor, and he'd come over, and I said, you know what you can do with those planes, don't you? The physical impossibility. And I quit. And the FBI escorted me out. And that subject never really hopped. And I had a change of heart. I don't know, you get a change of heart once in a while. You know, well, maybe they. I'll give them a break. So I called them. And I says, and I'm a farmer employee. And, oh, well, that's fine. I'd like to come back to work. And they go, oh, yeah, I'll look it up. And I heard the pause. It gave my name, and I still know the number. And so all of it, he saw the pause. He says, you want to know what they said? And I says, yeah. He says, don't even let you waste the ink. Ooh, that sort of degrades you. They're looking for wonderful people, and they wouldn't even hire me again. Incidentally, I got fired a lot of times. They say you couldn't get fired, but I did. And about this time, these little things called hallucinations start setting in. I mean, if you ever have them, I hope to God you know that. If you had them, you know what I'm talking about. And so I had three heads for 6 years. Two heads talking to me, and Mickey Hall, I think. You lay there, and they wake you up in the middle of the night if you're lucky to go to sleep, and they start telling you what a rotten bum you are. And you go to the bathroom, and they follow you, and they make fun of you. I get up, and I'd get so mad, I run in the bathroom, and I thought it was a bathroom, it's a closet, and I wet my wife's shoes, and what the hell. She had locked the closet door. I was a menace in my own house. So, a lot of things happen. This woman came up to me one day, and I was drunk, and I passed out. And she tied me up with a clothesline, And she had high heel on, and she tapped me out. She got my attention. That's one thing she got. And I thought it was funny. I said, the dog on me on half guard, and the dog just wagged its tail. And I said, what do you want? She said, you want to communicate with me. I said, what do you want to communicate about? She said, mind if I get a divorce? She says, hell no, but I get the dog. And that's what I got. And it wasn't long before the dog and I became outdoors. It's not a bad life. You don't have to pay taxes. You don't have to pay any rent. Sell a little blood once in a while. Try to stay out of jail. And I used to hear people when I first came to Alcoholics Anonymous, they said, I thought an alcoholic was a bum down on Skid Row, with that long overcoat on, eating out of garbage pails, sleeping in those places. And hell, I was all that, and I didn't think I was an alcoholic. I'm honest with you. I didn't want to be an alcoholic, because I heard about Alcoholics Anonymous, and I heard that they stopped drinking. And I never bummed around with people who didn't drink until I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I thought they were a bunch of squares, right? They didn't know what they was doing. They really didn't know how to live. And I used to tell them. You take an instance, they go in the bar and they take two drinks and they go home. Eat a nice meal, I guess, and do whatever they do. They go on vacations and I used to go to jail. Lincoln Heights became my second home. In fact, I use it for address. 119 North 19th Street. Ooh, Los Angeles. And if anybody's ever seen or hasn't seen, I'd like to describe it. On any given day of the week, there used to be anywhere from 100 to 150 drunks in the drunk scene. And the one who got there first got the wettest. One bathroom. That's all. And God, no pallets, nothing on there, just a cold concrete floor. And then they have gall to wake you up and call your name and say, you're all going out on a waiver. And they say, I don't want to get out, hell, I'm pretty comfortable right now. Let me sleep at all till morning. And if you don't go, well, of course, you're going to send you to court. And then you go out and you have to walk that last mile. My God, it's 3 blocks long, step by step. And you're shaken by that time. You're shaking, I mean. You're wondering where you can get that drink. Because, you know, you're in there on a bum beat. I was in there over 100 some times on a bum beat. And I only did it a day at a time. Simple as that. And I finally wound up in a county poorhouse in Los Angeles when I was 34 years old. And they 86 me out of there. Couldn't even make it in the poorhouse. That's sort of degrading. And I left there and I went back to the jungles. That's the only life I knew. People really tried to help me and befriend me. They wanted me to stop drinking. And they said, come on, I'll buy you a drink to get me to stop drinking. And that just didn't work. In fact, I was afraid to stop drinking, to be honest. I didn't know how to live in a world out there without drinking. It was a big fear. What do you do with your time? How do you live? What do you do? How do you talk to people? How do you dance? What's life all about? What do you got if you don't drink? Who's this life's dog? It was so pleasant for me. I'm leaving out the real bad ones. I'm just the hidden highlights. But, you know, finally my dog and I got tired of the Fifth Street and all that stuff. We decided to go and we got a beautiful apartment in Elysian Park there in Los Angeles. Beautiful. Wonderful scenery. And so I'm laying there one night with the dog for a pillow and I got that bottle of wine all of myself. And the first thing you know, I hear a guy. He knocked on the bush, you know what I mean? He said it was his place, you know what I mean? He just got out of jail, and he'd like it back, and I says, well, you know, when do you want me to move? He says, will you be out in the morning? I says, sure. And so the next day, I got me another bush, you know what I mean? It wasn't as nice, but, you know. And, you know, I mean, I settled for nothing, you know. And that was life, that was living. I couldn't drive a car anymore, all these voices that tell me, you know, and I was behind the wheel of a car and it turned here and turned there. Jeez, if I did that, I wouldn't be here. Probably taking a lot of people with me. So I quit driving. I didn't quit drinking, I quit driving. I was afraid to get behind a wheel. When I called up the FBI and I told them that these, whatever they were trying to pick my brain. They wouldn't know where I was and hung up, naturally. I wasn't about to cop out to them, you know what I mean. Anyway, life wasn't so great, you know what I mean? There was times I got hungry, right? And then I had a dog, I had a lot of excuses. You see it on TV, you see these men and women down there in these alleys behind these restaurants and going in these garbage pails, you know? And then looking up the can for your piece of steak or chicken, whatever happens to be, you know? And you wipe it off on that coat, you know, and you give the dog a bite, and you take a bite, you know, what the hell? This is real living. I got some good steaks and a lot of good chicken there, you know? Some people don't eat when they order, you know, maybe it could be alcoholics, I don't know, but anyway, I survived that way. Now, I wouldn't tell people about that, you know, I mean, geez, I was a big shot and everything was against me, people was this, people was that. I used to walk down the street with wet pants once in a while, and I considered myself a lover boy. You see some of these gals come down, they look so sweet, you know, I mean, Jesus, you're walking on like this, you know, and I'm looking at them. Hello, honey. Want to make love? Nate, darn hell, you're lost. They run. They're faded. The fact that he took me up on it, I was incapable of living in. I mean, why in such terror? What the hell? You know, I was flushed one day, and the dog and I were having a picnic. You know? I was in the park, and I had some beer, and I had some whiskey, and I had a saucer. I stole the saucer. And I had that. And so she used to drink a little beer, you know, and you got into the water. It was fun. You know, this day I got generous and gave her some whiskey. And the poor dog had a hangover for 3 days. Just looking around. And you know what? That dog swore off with or without a Salamo. Like, you never took another whiskey. Had more sense than I did. See, I'm a guy standing here tonight that was in that general hospital 17 times. Right? I was dying. I mean, and they'd take me in, they'd feed me intravenously, you know, and do all the things, give me vitamins. Then I'd get well and I'd put on that doctor's coat. I'd steal a doctor's coat and walk around and become a doctor. About evening this morning. What can I do for you? Oh, Jesus, you know. Nuts. Nuts. That's the way it was. That's exactly the way it was. I'm up for telling the truth. And, they'd look at me and they'd shake their head. I used to dole out pajamas. You're worse than you get a pair if you don't sleep in the nude. What the hell? I mean, you know, taking control. Finally, in my 17th visit, they kicked me out. And I threatened to sue them. You know what? They threw me out anyway. Suing out. They didn't want me. I run into town, run to the hospital. God, I can look back. A couple times dinner, it wasn't that funny. You know, they put me out in that hall, and they put that white sheet around, and you know what that means? You're going bye-bye, you know? And then I'd fool them, I'd be alive the next day, and they'd shake their head. And, you know, that's the way it had to be with me. I don't recommend that kind of life. It sounds fantastic. It wasn't dull, I'll guarantee you that. God, I suffered, you know what I mean? But I would then, nobody really know how I felt inside. And so a lot of women, believe me, and men try to really befriend me, they really did. And they take me to their homes, you know what I mean? And I put up a general appearance of being all right. And I just couldn't stay there. That guilt, again, I knew I was a nothing. I was a nobody going nowhere. And the biggest blow is when I had to get rid of that dog. I couldn't feed it anymore. I couldn't even steal for it. And it broke my heart, and the tears ran down, and I gave it to a deputy sheriff, and then I got drunk and stole it back, you know what I mean? And they put out a warrant for me, dog napping, and alone dog. And he finally said, if you don't do that again, I'll give you visitation rights. So that was better than nothing. Please be sure. But it took everything it took for me, except the fact. On September the 26th, I got off the streets finally. I used to try to work. I'd go to work, but I couldn't hold the job. Work wasn't that important. The blues was more important than anything. And, you know, I had good jobs even, and I bluffed my way through a lot of things. I didn't have that much talent, but I told them I did, too. And I was a good liar. I thought I was a good liar. And anyway, I got off the streets, and I was in this place, 17 people using one bathroom, you know, real swanky joint. And I used to tell people I'm the manager of it. Here, the truth was, I'm 6 weeks behind my room rent. And that's $6 a week, and I'm 6 weeks behind my room rent. And the police come in at one time, and on this particular day, September the 22nd, 1949, and I talked them out about, you know, these people were picking on me, you know what I mean? I wasn't raising all that hell. I wasn't doing this and threatening them. And so I talked them out of it, but after they left, I went down and had my revenge with these people. I started knocking on doors, you know what I mean, and calling some names that I don't use in Alcoholics Anonymous and all that necessary. A girl said to me one time, I thought I had to use that because I was a street person. And she says, you know what's wrong with you? And I said, yeah. She has lack of vocabulary. Jesus, that did it. And it woke me up. It really did. All these things that were said to me when I came to labor were very necessary. You see, I don't know how you feel about it, but I've been 86 out of bars for using language like that. And not in thrown out. And I seen it last night when I was in Redding, California. And some gal was there, and she was drunk, and she was drinking. And she was calling these two guys that looked like gorillas to me. And she was calling them more names, you know what I mean? And I said, my God, if you get through the night, kid, without getting killed, you're lucky. And then she'd run in the bus station, you know what I mean, for protection. And people, you know, they get a little bit shit-free. Somebody might get hurt. And I knew it wasn't going to be me. I guarantee you that. I wasn't going to interfere in anything. I had no right to it. But, I mean, I observed these things, and I watched it, and I see it happening day after day. You know, and I'd like to walk up and say, come on, you know, come join us and live a happy life. You know, you people look beautiful. God, God, I'm up here. You're so attentive, and you're sweet and kind and loving and responsive. You know, when I was on the stage, that's what I was looking for, the stage of starvation. looking for the audience and, you know, try to fit in society and be part of, you know, and I couldn't even say my ABC. You see, and Alcoholics Anonymous gave me that chance and choice and the benefit to further my education. And thank God I've been sober and I started doing it. But this particular day on September the 22nd, they took me to jail again. And here I had on a bathrobe and a shoe and a house slipper. That was my attire. And I had one of those afro robes before they ever had them. And they gave me a bad sign. And these voices were talking to me. I don't talk too much about them. I don't try to scare people. I don't want to tell you about the hell and the torment and the fighting and the crying and the screaming and the fear. God, when they'd come in busloads on me, and they'd crawl all over me, and they'd say things, and they'd threaten people I knew, and they'd threaten that dog. And God, you know, I just didn't know what to do. And I knew they weren't there, but I was afraid. And like this slasher. You ever hear of a slasher with that knife, you know? He just come up, and he'd put it in the back of my neck, and he'd say, "Turn your head." And I was about to turn my head. I knew he wasn't there, but I wouldn't turn my head. No way. I don't know. I'll guarantee you that. And so this night, you know, in the jail, I never want to forget it. And they booked me in and took my fingerprints and asked me, I thought I was tough. And I said, no, and they had a guy who was going to fight me. And I didn't fight him. I was a coward. Hell no, I didn't want to get killed. And I had to have much sense. But that night in there, I became a singer again. And these drunks don't like singers. In the trunk tank. Disturb the rest. And then these voices, for the first time, became kind. They became kind. And I was a sucker for kindness. And they told me that they would help me. And now they were flying around the room, and God, I could see them just in plain. They were putting water on my head and on my lips and talking kind to me. And I was willing to go blind that night. I was blinking my eyes. Anything. I knew I was at the end, and I knew it. Finally, I knew it. There wasn't anything I could do about it. And they told me what to say to the judge. I had to go to court the next day. And I said, right what they told me. I started following directions. And I went before that judge that morning, and thank God it was a substitute judge. And I told him what they wanted to hear. I told them that some people were going to help me with my drinking problem. And that was the first time in my life that I ever admitted that I had a drinking problem. I got counseling for a while. But you know, to me, that's the first step in recovery, right in the book called Alcoholics Anonymous. When I could conceive in my innermost self that I'm an alcoholic, this is the first step in recovery. You know, and then we go from there. The judge gave me the 90 days. I asked him for 90 days. I don't know if I said that or not, but that's insanity. But he did suspend the sentence. And he said, I hope you don't give these people the same trouble you gave us. And I left that place. And these voices were talking to me, and I got impatient. And they weren't hurrying fast enough. And so I took a cab. And in this house, I borrowed the money to pay off the cab, you know what I mean? And I went to this room, and it was filthy and dirty, and I can't explain it. You'd have to see it. And so here I am, and now, you know, I don't hear any voices. And then they came back, and they helped me go to sleep. They were dropping big pills in my, you know, shoot me, and God, I didn't care. I was beyond all help, and I knew it. And I went to sleep. About 9 o'clock that night, the only thing in 36 years that I had salvaged was a little white radio, and it wasn't even on. And I heard a voice say, "My son, this is your father. Everything's going to be all right." You see, I was used to voices, and I went to sleep. And the next morning, when I woke up, I wanted voices. I wanted direction, and there wasn't any. And you know what? Thank God they have never come back. They have never come back. For that admission and surrender. You know, I have a eerie feeling, but that's what happened to me. For some reason or other, the desire to drink me just pulled right out of me. And I read that also in the book, and one of the very fortunate ones. I didn't have to go out and fight this obsession to talk about it. And so anyway, I felt myself going. And I mean, I was leaving this earth, and I know it. And I don't know if anybody here ever fainted or passed out, and that's what I started to do. And I felt my knees on that cold linoleum floor, and my head on that wet bed. And I guess deep from within, I must have cried out for help, because I didn't know how to pray. And the words Alcoholics Anonymous came right in the conscious part of my mind. Glory to God. And then I felt the strength come back in my body, and I was able to walk 2.5 blocks to a telephone and call Alcoholics Anonymous. And they wanted to send people out to see me, but you all know the central office, how wonderful it is, how much they care and love, the love and service that we hear about. But I refused that help. I says, no, all I want to know is where's the meeting. And they told me, and I walked to my first AA meeting. I had on 2 pair of pants, one covering up the holes in the other. I didn't have any soles on my feet. I didn't have any, you know, socks. I had socks on, but they didn't have any feet in the meeting, but I was going to impress you. What the hell? I borrowed a coat. And I had a white shirt. White shirt. And I walked in, and they told me to see the secretary, which I did. And I says, they told me to see you, and I thought he said, sit down, shut up, and listen. I didn't like that, but that's what I heard. And then, you know, all of a sudden, like they did here tonight, are there any newcomers here? And 2 people pushed me up. I wonder how they knew. And you people clapped, and I bowed. And the guy, I heard a guy say, you never have to take another drink as long as you live if you don't want to. I never heard that before. I thought I'd die a helpless, hopeless drunk, you know, really out in the streets, killing somebody. And then he says, this Alcoholics Anonymous book. He says, where it really is, the page 164 pages. I said, that's nice. And then I heard speakers get up there that night, and they laid down their life for me. They talked about themselves, and they didn't seem unhappy about it. They really didn't. They seemed like me. I haven't a good time. I love to hear people laugh. And but they did. They talked about themselves. It was the first time I ever heard the drunks tell the truth. They talked about their escapades. They talked about their difficulties. And then I could see the success, the recovery. And this guy says, if you don't have the money, steal it. And I left ahead of him. Paid for it later. They knew I had them. They were more lean and tolerant those days. That's right. They were interested in my welfare, and they gave me all the love and the attention and wished that I'd come back. Imagine that. I left there with tears in my eyes, but I was high as a kite. And they gave me that hope. They really gave me hope that maybe I could do it with their help. And again, they asked me to come back, and God, I just couldn't wait to read that book, and they put literature in my pocket all over, and, you know, man, I walked out of there like a paper factory, you know what I mean? And I walked home. I had too much pride to ask anybody, you know, to give me a ride home. And I walked, and I enjoyed it. God, I walked. I almost flew home. I felt so high. I had found something at last that I didn't really realize. I really didn't realize what I had found that night. But I felt so much different. And the next morning, boy, I got up. And I went right next door to a man, 75, and a guy, 86. And I started really laying it on. After a 1 AA meeting, I'm carrying a message. Damn right. And they start getting, and I made the run for him. I went down and got him a bottle so they'd listen to me. My hell, yeah. See, I had to talk. When they passed out, I went down to the bar. And I started passing out literature. And I got 86 out of the bar. Sober then. But you see, and another thing I did, I heard him say they didn't stay sober a day at a time. They live a day at a time. And so I put an ad in the newspaper. Ex-drunk, now sober. Went to work. And geez, I didn't have a phone, but I had somebody else taking them for me. Right?
And I had more than I could handle. I started distributing a few, you know what I mean? And finally, about when I'm sober 2 months and people are becoming a little bit more interested in me, the guy walks up to me and says, hey, why don't you come to work where I do? I said, no, I don't work over a day at a time. I don't live over a day at a time. That's a little bit dingy. And he says, oh, come down to our place. It's only for 1 day. And I went down there. And I stayed a year, 10 months, a day at a time. Yeah. But see, I'd build up references. I really had no reference. Yeah, but this was good, and I'm grateful for it. I didn't like the job, but I did it. And another thing in those days, before they would let you leave a meeting, speak, or even if you said the Lord's Prayer, I think you had to be a cousin of Bill Wilson. I mean, after the meeting. But really, they held it pretty much to it. Nobody could, you know, be active as far as speaking or leading meetings. Picking up ashtrays, yes, and let me do that, sure. But really, it was the best thing that ever happened to me. And I used to sit back there and say, only listen to me. Good thing they didn't, they all probably went out and got drunk. But my attitude, you know what I mean, that's the way I felt. God, I want to get up there and really tell them. Oh, you know. And the guy says, you got to take the first step. Like, I don't got to do nothing. Says, suggest. He says, you want to live, don't you? We had a guy named Harry Chisholm. He used to get up there and he'd hold the book up. He was in Pasadena. And nobody else had books. And Harry would get there and he says, this is a vast program. Let's not try to do it half-assed, right? But I was a rebel, like most of us. Like it says there, what an order, I can't go through with it. Who is going to admit to God, to myself, and another human being? Not me. No, not me. They see what they see to get, right? But when the time come, you know, it was necessary. It was really necessary for me to start doing something about what they were talking about. I wanted to, really. I really, deep down in, I really wanted to. And it was in the book, and all I had to do again was follow direction. And when the 6 months come in, you know what I mean, God, now they come after me. Hey, we've been watching you. See, you're doing so good. You're making such progress. And I was like, who the heck are they talking about? But I was going to meetings, and I was staying sober. I was in a lot of activity. But see, I wasn't into that action. I really thought too much. As much as I was capable of doing or willing to do at the time. That's all I could do. The best of my understanding. And I'm grateful for that. I really didn't have people making me do certain things. They just suggested if I wanted to be happy. If I would do certain things, you know, maybe my life would change. And so, when I approached me on leading this meeting, you know what I said? No. The guy says, you never run away from a Bible, did you, brother? He hit me. Late in the middle of the night, I said, he said, Jesus, they sure had to scrape the bottom of the barrel. Woo! Thank God. And that's what I told the people, and you people laughed. I'm so grateful for that laughter. And then I found out that I could laugh at me. And you know, I did the same thing. I let the speaker speak that night. It was very good. But you know, I had all these growing pains to do. I was so enthused about Alcoholics Anonymous. When these fellas I used to drink with on the streets used to see me come and they'd run. They thought I was going to throw some holy water on them or something. I don't know what they thought from me. No, it took a lot. I don't know. I was pretty mixed up. I didn't have a sponsor right off the start. But I was doing things that I thought should be done and I was listening at meetings. And I was taking every thing that I could use, and I was trying to use it. And if it wasn't to be used then, it put it on the shelf for future reference. And then when 1950, when I come over and they, you know, they started these delegates, you know, to New York and all these conferences, and they had their first in Cleveland, Ohio, Dr. Bob was still alive. And this was the first one, and I got angry because they didn't send me. Jesus. We probably wouldn't have it today if they'd have sent me then, you know what I mean? But you know, I had a lot of growing pains. I had a lot of things and a lot of anger and a lot of hostility. You see, I was starved for love and affection.
And that's what you people were showing me. You guys like that prodigal son. When I went out there and I ate with the pigs and, you know, and all this, and I spent all this stuff, and when the time came, where else do you go? And God in His infinite wisdom, I might still say He guided me to Alcoholics Anonymous at my lowest ebb. And so I came to you people. If you gave me those ingredients of love, understanding, patience, tolerance, and I needed every bit of it. And you didn't run me away. You didn't run me away. You understood me. You knew where I was coming from. You need a lot of tolerance for a guy like me. And then you start getting me active. And you let me go into prisons. And you started letting me talk to the people. And I didn't want to go into prisons and talk to these people. Because you see, when I used to lay in jail, I didn't want people to come in and make fun of me. But it wasn't this way. Until I found out that I could go in and tell them my story. And say, hey, there's a way. And you know, it's amazing how many dedicated people are still doing these things. They're going into hospitals and jails and sanitariums and old folks' homes. And they're saying, hey, we got more drunken old people now. The young ones aren't so bad. The old ones are the ones that we got to do. After they retire, what have they got to do? And we find it's true. It's not funny. Their life is over. God, what have they got to live for? And they might take away whatever they got, you know. And so they do the next best thing. I have a lot of young people say, what can you do for my father? That's care of me. See, we do it over radio. We do it over TV. We let the people know, public information. This is service. This is what Alcoholics Anonymous, love and service. That's what Dr. Bob was talking about. We all know what love is, and we all know what service is. And so let's try to give what's been so freely given to us. You know, these people first went and came in Alcoholics Anonymous, didn't have it easy. They were shunned, and they were a bunch of crackpots. And they had a gimmick going, and Alexander went there, and he tried to say, you know, with the cult, and we're not trying to do this. And he became one of the trustees. But he saw the real sincerity about these alcoholics who were grateful for being alive, given another chance at life. Just giving them another chance at life and be able to walk tall with your head high and be proud to be alive and be grateful for this thing called Alcoholics Anonymous. Like with a lot of people, I had a lot of trouble with spirituality. I didn't understand it. I didn't understand religion. I heard it was a dogma, and you know, I knew nothing about it, really. And I heard you people talk, and I watched spirituality. That's all. I watched spirituality. I watched you working with drunks. I watched you give of yourself, you know, and help a man along that hold that hand. Or take those few following steps and say, come on, boy, join us. Like it says, and we shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit. And you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. When I read that, I had no understanding that I would be able to go around the world in different places and go in the hospitals and the jails and prisons and tell the truth about me. Whether you like it or not, that's the way I was. And I know what I'm trying to be like now. I'm trying to be the best me that I ever knew. And I am the best me. Because you people showed me how to live. I didn't know how to live. I didn't know how to live without drinking. But you told me, and you built up a defense, and it's all in the book called Alcoholics Anonymous and our other literature. And the honesty, open-mindedness, and just the willingness. And I guarantee you, when the time comes and you take this fifth step, and you get rid of all this junk that's been in our minds and our hearts, and that fear of other people, afraid to tell them about ourselves, and now all of a sudden, it's gone, and you can walk that way we're talking about. When I was real new on the program, I was in Highland Park. It's also in California, right outside of Los Angeles. And I heard a man speaking there, and his name was Chuck C. And he was talking about spiritual things. And after the meeting, I went up to him and I said, I don't understand. I said, you talk way over my head. I said, I never read the Bible. I know nothing about spiritual books. I never read spiritual books. And even if I had read them, I would have not understood them. I said, but I'll tell you one thing, Chucky Pope.
That's what Paul.
I says, in this book of Alcoholics Anonymous, I found the nature of my illness. And I find out when I do certain things, I feel good and clean inside. And no man can take that away from me. And Chuck says, don't ever read any books. He's been talking about that for over 35 years. And he became my sponsor. The sponsor, the friend. Now when Chuck is getting a little bit old, you know, he's just about 80, and it's not too bad. I'm going to be 70 pretty soon. It's not so old. I know I don't look it. You see, because I was immersed in alcohol for so long, it kept me, you know, sort of. I love the kid. I love to laugh. I love to hear that laugh. But when Chuck, you know, when he wants to walk on water now, I go down and help him. Your paper are wonderful. You see, we are Alcoholics Anonymous. We own this. We own alcoholics. Nobody can take this away from us. We all gave in the concept of AA, gave us the right, even a minority. If there's a disagreement, we were able to talk about it. We learned how to disagree without being disagreeable, didn't we? Jesus, wonderful. We used to slug each other, and then not anymore. Somebody's dull business. They're important. You see, we find out we own, you know, it's like owning a home that you just don't throw it away. And I believe, and it's strictly not only my belief, but a lot of others, if AA has ever fallen, it's not going to be from the outside. It's going to be from within. But as long as there's one sober person who believes in Alcoholics Anonymous and believes in this way of life, and are willing to practice the principles and carry the message to the alcoholic who's still suffering, we can't do it. With God on our side, who can be against us? Who can be against us? You see, I can talk about that. I pray to God every day because I know, and I pray and I have faith, otherwise I wouldn't pray, that He's going to help me to do the best I know how. And He's going to be with me in times of stress. And all I have to do, you see, each person in this room and in the world gets 1,440 minutes in a day, no more and no less. And what do we do with it? It's ours. It's ours as a gift. What do we do with it? You can start over any time of the day, isn't it nice? You don't say that, no, poor me, poor me, poor me, poor me, poor me. All you have to do is live and talk and go out and be happy to be alive, right? Happy to be alive. I am God, I'm so happy. I should be falling down, I should be tired. I had about 3 hours sleep last night. As soon as I see you people, the stimulation of love. And I feel it. I feel the power. I've been feeling it all day. And it keeps me alive and keeps my eyes open. September the 22nd, I am going to celebrate my 32nd Alcoholics Anonymous birthday, a day at a time. By the grace of God. In October the 19th of this year, I'll be 69 years old. Never thought I'd make it. Right? But I want to live a long time because I love life. In Grants Pass, we have a lot of meetings. In any place you're traveling, just look in a phone book all over the world. We have 110 meetings in 110 countries. We have over 40,000 meetings in Spanish, French, English, you name it, we got it. Right? And so there really isn't any excuse. If you can read the word Alcoholics Anonymous in the phone book, you can get in touch with somebody. You know, that's wonderful. God, look at it. We're going to be selling our 3,000,000th book next month. You know, it took us 34 years to sell the first 1,000,000. And then 5 years later, we sold the 2nd 1,000,000. And then within 3 years, we have sold our 3,000,000 book, which will be next month. I don't know who they're going to give it to, but they're going to give it to somebody. And I wish it'd be one of you. Because you see, we're all God's kids. We're all worthwhile. We all have a role to play in life. You see,
in Grants Pass, you might, when you get up there, you might see me running around on a motorcycle. How do you like that? Let's get it on, huh? Let's go. Let's live. I don't know about you. I did my dying out there. And you taught me how to live. And I'm so grateful. Coming down last night, again, the time in the, it presents itself for us to carry the message. And it was the thing that happened, and thank God I was there, and I could answer some questions, and gave this young, beautiful girl some hope, because her brother and sister were going to hell fast, and she didn't know what to do. And I hope to God. I hope that I never forget where I came from. You see, I never regret the past, and neither do I shut the door on it. I want to live today, because it might be 12 o'clock before long. And if I don't shut up, you run me out. But you know, we still the day when the day starts. You got 1,440 minutes of life to repeat. Let's make it worthwhile for yourself and people around you. When you go in these stores, you say practice these principles in all our affairs, right? You ever go in a store, I don't know how many name of stores you got in this town, and that girl around there, boy, she's trying to sack those things up in them and her people grouch in. Let me get up there and just say hi. Practice a little kindness. And then your family, you know, they deserve the best food. And thank God you're all standing. I love you all. God bless you and thank you very much.